Welcome to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. In today's episode, we've got Adam Ahmet, tax lawyer. Adam approached us about coming onto the show. Initially, I was a bit reserved. I was kind of working out how we would fill an hour on tax law. But it turns out that Adam had actually litigated a case involving Bitcoin. He also holds Bitcoin in his company's balance sheet, and we were able to talk about quite interesting topics such as smart contracts and inheritance planning, with his firm also doing accounting. This was a really interesting conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. But before we get to that, a quick note from the show sponsor. Hardblock is Australia's oldest Bitcoin-only exchange, established in 2014. Featuring automated DCA with 99 sat withdrawals, dedicated SMSF accounts, and Bitcoiner customer support. To find out more, email hello@hardblock.com.au or sign up with the link in the show notes for free automated Bitcoin withdrawals for 6 months. And now, here's the show.
Hello, Adam. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Jeremy, how are you?
Pretty good. Well, thanks for getting in touch with us. We've got a really interesting agenda lined up today. I was a bit surprised, to be honest, that I found so much to talk about in tax law and Bitcoin. But once I started talking to you, I realized there's plenty to talk about. So why don't we get started by just telling the audience, you know, who you are, what your background is?
Sure. Yeah, my name's Adam Ahmet. I'm a tax lawyer. I used to work at the bigger firms, and now I work in my own firm. Mm-hmm. And I ran a court case against the tax office about whether Bitcoin is a foreign currency. Unfortunately, I got the silver medal, but there was some serious consolation prizes in there as well. And that was
that case in a minute. It's certainly of a lot of interest. But so in terms of, like, you know, what made you move from a larger law firm to starting your own firm?
I think, you know, in the larger firms, I used to do a lot of work in banking and finance and private equity and those types of spaces, and it gets a little bit stale. It's very interesting and difficult work, but it can get a bit stale. Whereas when you're working with normal people running businesses, having a go, there's an excitement there, and you feel like you're actually contributing to the economy in a real way by helping someone out. That makes a really big difference. And it's just way more enjoyable.
That's very much aligned with the Bitcoin kind of moving away from the larger fiat type organizations and into more entrepreneurial businesses and so on. So taking it from there, so how did you first learn about Bitcoin?
So actually, I learned about it in either 2010 or 11. A friend of mine, which is actually a bit embarrassing story, but he came up to me and he said, oh, you should buy this Bitcoin. And I thought, okay, you know, maybe I will. What's it about? And he said, oh, you know, you can use it to buy stuff on the internet. And I was like, okay. And he said, you know, like on the dark web. And I was like, well, I'm probably not going to buy anything from there.
Yeah.
So, you know. So he actually was mining some Bitcoin at the time. He's actually lost the Bitcoin that he mined at the time. Wow. I don't know, he put it somewhere and he's lost it. So I didn't actually buy at that time. I didn't buy until maybe 2015 or 16, because I thought, you know, this is actually something serious. I think this is something that can be used by a lot of people. It's decentralized. You know, it has integrity to it because, you know, it's not subject to manipulation by a government. You know, like governments print money. You know, you're working hard, you're making money, put in the bank or whatever, and then they just print more of it. Whereas Bitcoin sort of has everyone knows what the rules are. You know, there's a finite amount, and, you know, there's just, you know, it doesn't have that same element of manipulation, you know, like everyone's on an equal playing field. I thought that was a really good thing. I thought this might be the future, so I should go ahead and buy some.
Absolutely. So you went and bought some in your company, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I did.
And so how did that come about? And, you know, were there any challenges in doing that?
Not really. I mean, you know, in those days, I think to buy, you had to, you know, deposit money in a random bank account, seemed like it, and then they just transfer the Bitcoin to you and you'd hope that they would do it. They didn't ask you who you were or anything like that. So it's really up to you then. I mean, in your own records, you can prove it because you can show the money came out of the company, put it on your balance sheet, and then, you know, that's evidence that it belongs there. So it's not, you won't get any certificate from the person who's transferring it to you, but in your own records will verify the ownership.
Now, what about in terms of, you know, because you're an accounting and a legal firm, the accounting side of having it on your balance sheet, were there any challenges there?
Not really. I mean, you can just put it on your balance sheet at cost if you want. And if you want to revalue, you can revalue if you want to as well. I mean, that's when you're a smaller business, you get that option. I think if you were a much larger business, then you'd start looking at things like whether you have to mark to market and that kind of stuff, as you have to with some derivatives. But when you're smaller, you don't necessarily have to worry about all that.
Yeah, excellent. So maybe just let's start in terms of the legal side. Do you want to give us an overview of how the kind of current currency constitutional laws came about, you know, around 100 years ago, and what the situation was like that in terms of money in the very early days of Australia?
Yeah, so in the early days, there wasn't really a lot of money around, so people had to still, you know, buy and sell and trade with each other, and so they used all sorts of things. And one of the currencies at the time was actually rum, and so people would buy and sell things in rum, and then you can obviously drink the rum too if you want to.
Yep.
They also had individual banks issuing their own currency, and people were using that. And so currency's always been something that is something that people will accept in exchange for services, but it's something that's sort of widely accepted for services by a lot of people in the same item. So over the course of time, people have used salt, mm-hmm. for example, as well as currency. If you arguably we use metal, you know, with the coins,
yep.
or pieces of paper, you know, right now. It's just some kind of item.
And so we're talking about what, late 19th century? Is that when they were using rum as currency? Roughly when was that?
Yeah, that's around that time, yeah.
Okay, and then the government introduced laws addressing that. So what did they do there?
So when all the colonies became Australia, you know, we obviously enacted a constitution, and the constitution gave the power to issue and make currency to the federal parliament.
Right.
And so if you look at the powers that the parliament has in the constitution, there's a list of them, and one of them is actually currency. So at the time, you know, people, you know, if you've been used to doing your own thing, and all of a sudden the government says, well, no, we get to choose what the currency is and what's not, you know, obviously there's a little bit of an issue there. So there were actually some early court cases, and there were questions around whether certain things were currency or not, and therefore within the Commonwealth regulating power. What the government wanted to do is they wanted basically everyone to use the currency that they chose and use only that and nothing else. So they had to stamp out, obviously, the use of rum and all this other stuff.
Sure.
And so in those court cases, the High Court did say, well, yeah, those things are currency, and so they're within the regulating power of the federal parliament, and you have to, you know, you have to use what they tell you to use, basically. You know, they can regulate the usage of rum or whatever if they want to.
Okay, and so that was kind of an interesting precedent, I guess, that you used to then take to court a case against the ATO around Bitcoin. So do you want to introduce that, and what was the motivation for doing that?
Yeah, well, you know, I unfortunately, to my embarrassment, one of those people who made a little bit of a loss on Bitcoin because I panicked and I sold at a loss. And position was that obviously that's a capital loss. I didn't want that. I wanted a revenue loss so I could offset against my other income. And I thought, well, the only way I can get around it is if it's a foreign currency, because foreign currencies have a slightly different set of rules. And so I argued that it was a foreign currency and therefore I should be allowed to claim that loss against my other income. And a foreign currency is basically defined as a currency other than Australian currency. It Yep. doesn't say another country's currency. It says any currency other than Australian currency is foreign, right? So I thought, well, that means it's very wide. It's just basically anything anyone uses as a currency. Even rum is a foreign currency, right, by that definition.
Yep.
And so I put that to the tribunal and I said, look, you know, based on the Australian constitutional definition of currency, Bitcoin is definitely a currency. The reason why is people use it to transact with each other. It's a means of exchange. And the reality is that with Bitcoin, you know, that's basically what it is functionally. I mean, if you look at it deep down in terms of the script itself, what I explained to the tribunal was it's just a payment waiting to happen, essentially. You know, the script is waiting for you to tell it who to pay it to. And that's essentially what's happening. And then the next person, the script is waiting for them to tell who to pay it to and so on. And so its function is purely for payment. And therefore, it very squarely lands in a currency. The tax office was saying, you know, an item, it's like gold or something. And I said, well, gold you can wear and, you know, you can do other things with potentially. But with Bitcoin, it's clearly only for transacting. You know, that's the whole reason why it seems to be there. And so you can't, you know, try to put it as an item of property as such. It's definitely a currency. I thought I'd be a bit clever as well. And so what I did was I said to the tribunal, well, if you don't, you know, because I was telling them Bitcoin's being used by people to pay for things. And the tribunal member was a nice man, but slightly more elderly. And he was thinking it wasn't very, very used. So I actually also gave him examples of people who'd been prosecuted under financial legislation for dudding people of their Bitcoin and so on and so forth to show it's a bit more like money. But I also said to him that, and this is in the transcript, I said, well, if you don't do this, then all of those rules that were around, that, you know, all of those things people used to do before the Forex rules came about in the early 2000s are open again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it used to be that when people transacted in US dollars or other currencies, it didn't always trigger taxation. And there was a case about that called ERA. And after that, the government was like, well, no, we need to tax these gains and stuff on foreign currencies. And so they introduced a whole raft of laws.
Sure.
And I said that all the stuff that was going on back then, that those laws are supposed to stop now, is back in play.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it will be back in play if you don't consider it a foreign currency, because people can transact in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies in a way that doesn't trigger taxation then if they're basically using it as a currency. And I thought, oh, you know, I've probably got them. I've told them the Constitution. I've told them that they're opening up a massive tax loophole and everything like that. So I thought maybe I might win. But the tribunal just said, well, you know, yes, there's a loophole there and that's Parliament's problem, they have to fix it.
Yeah, interesting. So I think a lot of people in the Bitcoin space probably aren't that familiar with those rules. But just for some context, so this was in 2020, right? So this is before El Salvador made Bitcoin legal tender. So I guess you're probably the first person to really point at that loophole that existed. So do you think, because it's quite timely at the moment, the government is deciding on whether Bitcoin should be, or all cryptocurrencies should be, a foreign currency, and their position is that it shouldn't. What is your position now, or your thinking now, that El Salvador has made Bitcoin legal tender? Do you think it should be a foreign currency or it should not?
Well, I think I accept the decision of the tribunal, but I think that it's clearly a currency. I just don't see what else it could be. I mean, people call it cryptocurrency as well. It's in the name.
Yeah.
So I just don't see how it couldn't be a currency. Then for the foreign currency rules, all it has to be is a currency other than Australian currency, which it obviously, if it's not Australian currency, it's a currency that's not other than Australian currency. What the tribunal said was, well, you know, to be a currency other than Australian currency, you have to be a currency, and to be a currency, you have to be recognized by or issued by a government. And so now with El Salvador, I suppose using that test, it's recognized by El Salvador, it becomes a foreign currency, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what's triggered this, because I don't think that the government wanted that outcome, because now that it's recognized by somebody, it meets that that test. And so that's what I think. I think even the government would then acknowledge then that at the moment, based on the legal precedent, Bitcoin is actually a foreign currency for tax purposes, which is why they're changing the law.
Yeah. So, and if people are not aware, there are some law changes being, I guess, put through at the moment. One is around foreign currency, but there's another, you know, a whole suite of tax laws for cryptocurrencies, which assume that the foreign currency law is going to be clarified. So Bitcoin and all cryptocurrencies will not be a foreign currency, which, to be honest, I kind of agree with, because it's not issued by a foreign government. It's not issued by anyone. So I kind of see that it does make sense to have its own space where it's regulated. So one of the things that I find, and as Bitcoiners, we find very interesting, but it's sort of hard to explain sometimes, is the difference between, say, Bitcoin and altcoins. So Bitcoin is fully decentralized and not issued by anyone, but essentially some of the altcoins, in fact, a lot of them, you could say are privately issued. So they issue tokens to themselves, and then they can control the money supply. So they're effectively like a fiat currency that has been issued by a private group. Do you see any way that that might be captured in the law, like some more clarity around, you know, what does decentralized mean, or, you know, might they carve a niche out for, say, privately backed cryptocurrencies?
I think that there could be. I mean, we have to sort of, with laws, you always have to just take a step back and see what they're trying to do here.
Sure.
And you can work from that. So with, generally speaking, they want to figure out a way to tax something,
yep.
You know, if, especially if people are making money. And so I don't know if having laws that are separate for Bitcoin versus other altcoins actually necessarily connects with that. So they might make a, like when mining was going really well, for example,
yep.
The government introduced a mining tax, and when but by the time they came about to implementing it, the mining boom was over.
Right.
And when the financial markets were going crazy before the GFC, the government introduced TOFA, taxation of financial arrangements legislation, to sort of tax that stuff. But then the GFC hit, so they brought it in just in time for when, you know, no one was making money anymore on it. So I think you know, it will be the same probably with cryptocurrencies, and as this develops and things change, what they'll do is when they become aware that people are making a lot of money from something, let's say you make a lot of money from an altcoin and it's not getting taxed or it's being used in a particular way, I think at that time you'll start to see some legislation come through to try to collect money on it.
I see, yep.
It would work that way, as opposed to a principles-based approach of saying, hey, these things are different, let's work out a different way of treating them.
I see. So they don't really care as long as they can sort of tax them in some way.
That's right. Well, they care if they're not getting the money.
Yeah.
And they perceive that people are making a lot of money from it, and they want to get a larger slice of the pie, and then they'll make a change specifically for that. That's what tends to happen.
Okay, so if the pace of Bitcoin innovation is faster than the pace of tax innovation, there might be some ways to get around it, I guess.
It always will be that way, because the law takes such a long time to change, and it usually changes just in time when the party's over. And that's,
yep,
unfortunately the reality. You know, people start to move on to other things. You know, like, think about it this way. You know, if you bought Bitcoin in 2010 and you managed to hold on to it for this time, you've made a lot of money. But
yep,
no one who buys Bitcoin today is going to possibly make as much money as someone who bought it in 2010 or even 2015.
Yep.
You know, because it's already had a bit of a run.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you won't make it, but obviously the later you come into it, you know, the less there is. So, you know, this is a reaction to that first phase when people just do crazy well. And that phase obviously is past, you know, because everyone then becomes aware of it and the profits are less. So we'll always be, tax law is always behind.
Yeah. The next stage is now payments. So using the Lightning Network, people are looking to make payments. So potentially it'll take them a long time to realize that that's what's going to happen and think about whether they even can tax it, because the volume of payments is going to be so huge. Okay, so what were the outcomes for you in terms of that case? Were you able to make use of that loophole yourself, your company, or how did that work out?
I didn't actually myself. I thought about it, but you basically need to be doing a transaction with another counterparty, obviously, to take advantage of that. So you have to have a reason. You have to have a reason to do it. It's kind of like if I told you that the government's giving $5,000 to anyone who buys a new house. That's great, you know, you can get that $5,000, but you also need to be wanting to buy a new house, you know?
Yes.
Otherwise, it's pointless.
Yeah, exactly right.
So I didn't actually have any transaction that I would be doing that I would be using it. So I haven't used it myself.
Okay, no worries. Well, your firm also does other stuff that's actually quite related to Bitcoin. So I wanted to touch on a few other topics. One of them is around estate law. So one of the challenges that Bitcoin presents is around inheritance planning, because in order to secure it, you don't want anyone to know your private key and your passphrase and so on. But in order to pass it on to someone else, like your children, somehow they need to have access to that. Have you ever thought about how that kind of self-custody aspect of Bitcoin will interact with, you know, the estate law kind of industry and managing people's wills and so on?
Yeah, I mean, this is the interesting thing, because Bitcoin is actually very different in this regard. When you've got the way estate planning and probate and those types of things work is you can go to a central authority and say, look, this person's passed away. Using the apparatus of the state and the laws of the state, can you transfer everything to me? So if it's a property, go to the land titles office, give them the document and you can transfer the land to your name. If it's a bank, you go to the bank and give them the document and they can transfer the bank account to your name and so on and so forth. So there's someone to give that, you know, probate to. Whereas with Bitcoin, who would you give it to? You know, there's no one to give it to as such. So you don't have, that same setup. I think in that case, you'd have to recognize that that's the case and then do whatever is necessary while you're still alive to make sure that, you know, your Bitcoin can be accessed. I mean, it's the same problem as, say, my friend I mentioned who had the Bitcoin from 2010 and lost it. Yes, it was his. He's lost it. He obviously would love to get it back, mm-hmm. but how is he going to do that?
Yeah, he can't. So I guess, do you foresee a situation where maybe estate lawyers might hold like private keys for people, or maybe like one key in a multi-sig or something, and kind of be a mediator? Or do you think that's a possibility? Like, because the security implications are pretty serious in terms of having to do that. And if you lost it, do you think that's the path that people will go down, or is it people will just have to make their own arrangements, as you suggested before?
Well, you have to trust someone.
Yep.
You know, whether that's your lawyer or it's somebody else, you're just going to have to do that, I think. I don't know if there's any way around it. I mean, if I were, I probably would, this is what I personally would do. I would, if I wasn't using, you know, an exchange with custody, you know, who obviously then has, you have the ability to contact them and talk to them and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I would probably, let's say I had three children and I wanted them all to have a third each. I'd probably just set up three wallets.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
And while I'm alive, and then I could keep control of them, or, and I could give the keys to the kids if I wanted to or whatever. and then it's already done. Because if you just have one wallet and you say to that one person, hey, can you split this with two or three other people?
Yeah.
There's a huge risk there that, you know, like they, you could trust them, but, you know, it could also go wrong and you're not going to be around to sort it out. And there's no one that they can appeal to or anything like that. And it's just like a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah. So essentially you're putting yourself out of business. That's what you're saying.
I'm trying to give people a proper answer, I suppose. But yeah, I suppose I am.
Yeah. So maybe potentially a state law focuses on, you know, retail residential property and other things in the physical world. And the money as Bitcoin is, people have to sort it out by themselves if they're doing self-custody.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, like if you had, like, say, a parent who has a lot of Bitcoin and gives it only to one child, you know, and the other children miss out, they still have a claim under the family provision legislation they could make. But what would happen in practice in that situation is they would obviously sue the estate and so on and so forth. But, you know, getting the, you know, you couldn't force the transfer. You'd have to basically, you know, get the money off the person who has it and then say, well, that's okay, I've taken all your money because you've got all the Bitcoin, you can just reimburse yourself. You know, you'd have to do something like that. That would be how it would play out. Yeah. They do something similar in family law, you know, when they divorce and someone's gone, been clever and said, well, you know, I don't own anything, it's all owned by this family trust. And so, you know, in the divorce proceedings, you can't have any of my assets because I don't have any. And the court will say, well, how about I just make a judgment against you for $1 million or some large number, and I'm sure magically you'll be able to find the money to pay it. You know?
Yeah. You can see divorce would be an area of where it could get very murky.
Yeah.
You know, if one person takes the assets, or I suppose if they have, maybe you have to pre-set up like a multi-sig wallet or something. But yeah, it's just such a new way of thinking that I think there's a lot of issues where, people might find out the hard way that Bitcoin doesn't, it's not as forgiving in some ways. It's obviously much better in a lot of other ways, but in some ways it's not as forgiving in those kind of disputes.
Yeah.
Okay. So your firm also, and you have done before some auditing for accounting auditing. And one of the things we've noticed, because I have my SMSF set up and with some of our customers as well, is the auditing processes seem to vary significantly, and they seem to not really, because in Bitcoin, we really like to literally audit, say, the software. I mean, I can't personally do it, but people audit the software to say, is this doing what it says it can do? But some of the information requests we hear about from auditors are like, they want to see a PDF with this letterhead and an image on it, which anyone could fake. So do you think auditors understand Bitcoin, and what are they looking for when they're trying to audit Bitcoin in an SMSF, for example?
Oh, they want to verify two things. They want to verify that the fund owns it and what the balance was at 30 June.
Yep.
And those two things. And whatever paperwork or documentation you can give that will verify those two things, that's basically what they're looking for.
Right. So, you know, potentially it might be an idea to suggest, you know, understanding those two factors, suggest that I could provide this documentation that meets these requirements rather than getting an auditor. Because I've heard things like they want to see a screenshot or like an account statement, but if you're doing self-custody, that's just completely irrelevant, because everyone can check the blockchain at any time and say, this is, if you give an address, this is your Bitcoin. So as long as you meet those two requirements, it sounds like that actually would pass an audit.
Generally speaking, that's what they're looking for, but every auditor will be a little bit different because they'll have a different knowledge of cryptocurrency. Like you mentioned, you know, they might ask for a screenshot of something, and you might, because you know a bit more about the field, you might think, well, that doesn't really tell you anything, but they think it does. I think that's why that's happening.
Okay, but as long as they sign off on it, then I guess it's okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what they're trying to do. But I think at the end of the day, as long as your super fund actually does own it, you know, fundamentally, whether you can hand on heart say, well, this belongs to my super fund and this is actually the balance, some way, somehow, you'll be able to prove it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I kind of have heard that previously, where it just comes back to, if you say it's that's the truth and it's the truth. And you may as well not have the rest of the process if you can just say, yeah, I've got it and trust me. But yeah, so it's an interesting kind of area there. Okay, yeah. So we also talked when we last caught up about contracts, and you mentioned in the legal profession, I guess contract knowledge is kind of handed down from generation to generation and they slowly improve. And in, you know, we're starting to see, you know, certainly in altcoins, but it will come to Bitcoin, smart contracts. What's your view on smart contracts and how they might, what role might they play in the legal field in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think smart contracts are the future. To elaborate on the point you were making, I think that there's sort of two sides to it at the moment. Now, when someone asks me to draft a contract, you'll see that lawyers write contracts with heaps of material in there, mm-hmm. words, but it's because there are, over the passage of time, there are heaps of different situations that arise. And the goal is, when you're drafting a contract, to make sure you cover off on all the reasonable possibilities so that there's a minimal chance of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you've thought about all, you know, different combinations and you've agreed with the other side on what will happen in those situations. So everybody's yep. kind of square.
Yeah.
And so that, like you mentioned, is a body of knowledge and experience over a period of time and countless transactions over hundreds of years and so on and so forth. And on the smart contract side, you have a lot of people who are very good at coding and so on, who can, you know, do the script for this particular, for these types of transactions. But, you know, they know how to do it at a technical level, but don't have the benefit of that sort of experience. So, but whereas a law firm wouldn't have a clue how to make a smart contract, you know, so you sort of got two very necessary skills that aren't connected to each other. And I think that at some point in time, if there's a lawyer who understands enough about cryptocurrency and someone who could code, is good at coding and can understand and understands just enough basics about the law, and those two sort of work together, you could start to have very effective smart contracts made. And I think once you do that, I think that will spread. And it'll be amazing because, you know, at the moment, contracts are based on the laws of different states.
Mm-hmm.
And with a smart contract, at least for basic things, you know, you can have an arrangement and sort of self-executes and it's automatic. And you can, you know, like it, just the possibilities for trade just, you know, become stateless and anyone can interact with anyone else. And, you know, it's a common language. It would be amazing. It's kind of like Bitcoin now where anyone from anywhere can use it and transact with anyone else. Now you can actually have contracts, which is the basis of commerce. And I think whichever cryptocurrency is able to effectively connect into that will be the currency of the future.
Yeah. Well, obviously on this podcast, we think it's Bitcoin. And there are some contracts coming to Bitcoin. I think that space is still in its infancy. And I think for the reason you've kind of just pointed out, which is that there's just not that learning, that body of knowledge that that the lawyers have and, you know, the developers are still kind of learning that. And you make a really interesting point about the ability for the smart contracts to just bypass all of the jurisdictional challenges, I suppose, of, yeah, even within Australia, like different states have different laws. You just make it into sort of one, you know, one ruling. So do you kind of see a situation in the future where maybe lawyers have like developers on hand that write smart contracts and the lawyers kind of design the overview of the smart contract? Do you think that might come about?
I think they'll probably be fused into one, really.
Yep.
I think that's probably what will end up happening. I mean, I'd love to be that guy, but you know, we are at the early stage, but I think it will be fused. It's kind of like saying, you know, if you went back, you know, 100 years saying, do you think there'll be a you know, how would you fuse someone who uses a computer or typewriter, I suppose, with a lawyer? I mean, they used to dictate. So
yeah, sure.
Now it's sort of, you know, mesh together. I mean, I obviously type stuff myself now, and it's just commonly accepted. I mean, when I remember when I first started working, and I was a graduate at Allen's, I said to one of the partners there, he told me that, you know, obviously there weren't computers around as much when he was starting out. And I said to him, how did you do any work? I mean, I'm always sitting in front of the computer, so how did you do anything? Like, how did you write letters and stuff? And he just looked at me like I was a buffoon. He didn't answer my question. I still am not sure.
With a pen, I guess.
You know, I think he said, oh, there were typists. And as though it was the most obvious thing. And I said, okay, well, but how does, I mean, like, what do? You dictate to them or do you write it by hand? And he just stopped. He just looked at me like I was a buffoon. I actually just don't even know. I actually am still wondering. I wish I'd pressed him, but I got embarrassed, so I didn't.
Oh, it's a great analogy. So potentially in 20 years when kids are going to uni to study law, they're studying programming and smart contracts alongside law. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
I think you'd have to.
Yeah.
You know, if you're working in that field, you'd have to.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. And so, you know, if a smart contract gets hacked, like it's kind of like the loophole you talked about previously with foreign currency, that is kind of the smart contract equivalent of a loophole. So if a smart contract gets hacked, is that legitimate? Like, is that person entitled to what's in the smart contract? Or, you know, what's your opinion on that situation?
Well, I mean, this is a question. Would you then go to the courts? And you probably would.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd say, look, you know, this got hacked, and there's principles of contract law. You know, like the contract could have been frustrated, or it depends on exactly what happens. Like, if someone hacks it, and so the payment goes to someone else. Well, obviously the payment's not made, and then by law, what would happen is obviously someone's stolen it. So you'd have to get recourse against the person who's stolen it to get it back and all that type of stuff. And so you have to divide up, you know, how every part of it is dealt with depending on the particular situation. But I don't know if the courts would be in a position to work out, you know, to understand what even happened, you know. That would be interesting. I mean, I remember just dealing with the tribunal with the Bitcoin. I don't know if they would really. I think they'd probably say, this is probably what would happen. They'd say, look, I want expert evidence, and they'd get some expert to come in and explain what happened.
Mm.
And then they'd say, okay, well, who's legal? Who is their legal recourse against? I mean, the person who made the smart contract, were they negligent? You know, is there recourse against them?
Mm.
The person who stole it, obviously there's some recourse against them. And you'd have to, you know, what happens to, you know, the different, to the assets and all that kind of stuff. And they'd work out what the outcome should be. But then you'd have an issue of enforcement too. I mean, what if everyone's in different countries? We have that same problem now, where you have to try to get things enforced in different countries. And unless it's something depending on the country, sometimes it is a bit too hard at the moment. That might be the case then as well.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think the Bitcoin and then the smart contracts and the things that can be built on top of Bitcoin are just going to create a whole lot of situations that just don't mesh with the existing system and way of thinking. Because it's likely if a smart contract was hacked, that person would be in another country and probably even anonymous, that you'd never find them. So it really comes back to, you know, having really high quality smart contracts written. Okay, so you talked a bit about your sort of knowledge of the Bitcoin, the way currency laws apply to Bitcoin. Are there any tips you've got for people who've made gains on the Bitcoin on how to reduce their taxes?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot. The reality with taxes is it's not as easy to do something after an event, you know. If you're going to do something, you really need to plan ahead.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, even the legislation gives you choices. There are elections and things that you can make about how things will be taxed. And then if you don't make those elections, or you're not aware of them, then you sometimes sail through and you end up in a unfavorable situation and then you're just stuck there.
Yeah.
And then people will say to me, oh, can I change it? Sometimes you can't. Most of the time you can't. So you have to think these things through in advance. That's really the only way. The tax legislation sometimes gives incentives for people to do certain things as well because the government's trying to encourage certain behavior. I'll give an example, not in Bitcoin, but it's a very simple one, for example, where you can get a research and development grant from the government, you know, if you do research and development work. So let's say someone's trying to develop a smart contract or something like that and they're pioneering something new. Whatever you spend on that, you know, you'll get a rebate back from the government, right? And that's fantastic. But it only works if you use a company. If you do it in your own personal name, then you don't get it.
Right.
So people will come to me and say, hey, I spent all this money in research and development. Can I get it back? They didn't have a company. They did it in their own name. They miss out. So that's what I mean by you need to sort of think it through at the beginning.
Yeah.
If you know you're going to do research and development, use a company.
Okay.
You know, if you want to get the research and development grant, because if you don't, you won't be able to claim it. It's just how these things are set up. So not all the, you know, same with after the Bitcoin case where the tribunal confirmed the position, there are certain transactions that might not be subject to tax anymore, but there are certain transactions that are. And if certain transactions are allowed without tax and you know what they are, then and you have the choice, then you could say, well, if this is what the tribunal says I can do, then I should do this if I want this outcome. If you don't do it that way, then you won't get the outcome.
Yeah.
Because that's what they're encouraging. So, you know, that's why it's handy to do it in advance. If the people, a lot of people do it after the fact, but if they happen to be able to claim something, it's more based on luck, I suppose, than anything else.
I see. So if you are going to maybe buy a sizable amount, maybe have a think about the best structure and way to do that. That's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah. And you can take into account the estate planning and all these other things as well. You might as well.
Yep. Okay. You know? That's certainly planning ahead. Okay. So one final question. Bitcoin and Lightning essentially kind of brings back a digital version of cash payments. So they're much more anonymous, peer-to-peer, without that oversight. And, you know, over the last, let's say, 10 years, you've seen much more integration of the ATO systems with bank accounts so that they can see everything that's going on. And I think there's probably much more taxing going on because of that. If we go back to a society that's more kind of cash, digital cash-based and more like citizens have to declare their tax rather than it being spied on and probably are going to pay less tax, do you think there'll be implications for the way tax laws are set up to deal with that?
At the moment it's, you know, you know, it's based on a trust system where you say, this is what I earned. And then you do sort of get spied on and verified. Are you asking if that would change?
Well, if we go back to more of a cash based society, but it's just a digital cash, how do you think the government might respond to that? You know, if they're not able to see what everyone's doing, you know, might that change the way they try to tax you? So rather than taxing your income, might they do more of a GST or type situation? Or if we went back to a fully cash society and the government couldn't see anything and no one had to declare what they're actually doing, how might the government respond to that?
Probably the same thing that they do now. This is what they do now with cash, for example.
So
if the tax office audits you, they'll first audit you because they've picked up something, you know, like they might, let's say you're a fish and chip shop or something and you've got a lot of cash sales. They'll say, okay, you seem to have a lower profit margin than most other people. Mm-hmm. So there's a chance that you're skimming some of the cash.
Yep.
And when they audit you, the first thing they'll do usually is they'll just contact the bank directly and they'll just get all your bank statements. And I think what will happen is with people using cloud software like Xero, MIB, and so on, I think if they're not already doing it, they will just contact those people and then they'll just get a dump of your accounts.
Yeah.
So before they've even contacted you or said anything, they already know what's going on.
Yeah.
And then they'll send you an audit letter and say, you know, do you have anything you want to tell us? At that point in time is probably the best time to, if you wanted to come clean, so to speak, to come clean, because, you know, they already know everything and they're testing your honesty.
Yep.
And if
yep.
you come across as dishonest, you're basically screwed.
Yeah.
If they think that. And what they'll do is, so you've asked how would they, what would happen, you know, in terms of collection, so on. You're really saying, well, how do they know and what will they do? I mean, if I made $100 in cash and I said I made 20, what are they going to do about it? This is what they will do. The way they do it, and this is what they do now, is they will guess what your income should be and they'll guess high, right?
Yep, yep.
So they'll say, well, you've declared $100. I reckon it was really 1,000.
Yep.
Some ridiculous number, right? Mm-hmm. And they'll say, well, and tax on $1,000 is obviously like 10 times what you've declared, so here's your bill.
Yep.
And they can actually take that to the court or take that to the bank.
Wow.
And just take it out of your bank account, right, like that, through garnishee. Once they tell you the number, you owe that money. And it's up to you to prove that they're wrong, right? Mm. So then you're the one who has to come and say, okay, here are all the sales I made, here's all my receipts, here's everything, like, and you have to prove that you didn't take any cash out. And so they'll do the same here with the digital. They'll just say, well, this is what I think, and then you'll have to prove it. Because their view is, well, you know, if, you know, like, if they do that to you, then you're going to do what is necessary to prove that that's not the case, and they'll get to see everything, right, rather than them trying to work it out first.
Yeah, right. So this a couple of really big implications there. One is the centralization of accounting in sort of cloud solutions is kind of a risk that that information is very easy to access. So I know a lot of small businesses will be using Xero and similar competitors rather than, you know, you used to run that on your own computer. So that's a pretty big risk. The other potential is for the government to do more auditing as a proportion of their kind of work, which the reason I bring that up is in America, I don't know if you know, their latest bill had money for like 87,000 additional auditors for the IRS.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they have like 12,000 at the moment. It was like a ridiculously large number compared to what they already have. And you think, why are they doing that? So maybe they're already seeing that this is coming and they want to get ahead of it. Okay, so the way that they would respond is not with different tax laws, but maybe with more auditing.
Yeah, and they'll just give you bills. And that's what they do.
Yeah, right.
All the time. Yeah, most of, because I deal with a lot of audits, I get people with very large bills, and then, you know, it always gets reduced eventually. Like, I had one person who had a bill for $6.5 million. It got reduced to $20,000.
Wow. You know,
that's the variance. And that's a very common thing. One person had $2.5 million, got reduced to $2,000.
Goodness.
There was a guy who had $3.5 million reduced to $700,000. I have one right now that was $1.5 million and it's reduced to a refund.
Wow.
Right? And this is just how it is. That's how they roll. Because, they get frustrated after a while, right?
Yep.
And they just go, well, you know, if you're going to do that, then here's the bill.
That's crazy.
And people... Yeah, don't want. Obviously, they know it's wrong, so then they do whatever they can to fix it.
Well, that's probably a pretty good segue for you to give a plug to your business. Do you want to let people know what's the name of your business and how can they find you on the web and how can they call you and so on?
Okay. So I have two businesses, one for law and one for accounting. Mm-hmm. The law practice is called Specialist Law.
Yep.
And the accounting practice is Entity Accountants. But confusingly, the website we use is adamahmed.com.au, that's my name. So if someone wanted to look us up, you could go to Adam Ahmed, adamahmed.com.au, or just call us. Our number is pretty easy to remember, 02-7200-8200. That's a real number.
Yep.
So, that work. You know?
Put that in the show notes. And if you do have a $3 million tax bill, give Adam a call. He might be able to help you out.
Yeah. Hopefully no one's in that situation. But, yeah, I mean, you can always – those things you can always sort out.
Yeah, it would be a pretty stressful letter to receive, I'm imagining.
Yeah, no one enjoys receiving that. So it can be comical. I mean, for someone like me, because I see it so regularly and the tax office always does it the same way, it can be comical. I mean, like one of the things they'll say, like, because imagine if someone said to you, Jeremy, look, you've got a $6 million tax bill. It implies that you've got like $20 million or something, right? And so you'd say, well, where's that $20 million, right? They'll say, oh, you just collected in cash. And sometimes it's over a 1 or 2 year period, so that's a lot of cash. And you'd be like, well, where's it all stored? Like, that's a lot of money to store, what, under a mattress or something?
Yeah.
And if there's nothing to show for it, they'll just say, you know, oh, you gambled it away, or, you know, you're a drug addict or something. Like, they'll see that you might have bought something from Dan Murphy's once, and so they'll assume that you just spent it on booze. It's actually, you know, when you, if it's not happen, you know, if you take a step back and look at it, it's quite comical. I mean, it's not for the person at the time. When it gets sorted out, they probably still don't find it funny, but it's just so bizarre because no one on the street like expects that that's what's happening, but it is. And yeah, it's very common.
That's insane.
Yeah.
We might wrap it up there. So thanks so much for giving your time and those insights, because it is quite unique in the Bitcoin community to hear someone who is a tax law specialist explaining, you know, where did our money come from in Australia? Because a lot of the focus is elsewhere in America and so on, and how the government really works behind the scenes. So some really interesting insights there. So, yeah, thanks very much for that today, Adam.
Yeah, no worries. Well, thanks for having me, Jeremy.